Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to ask for a bit of support. I've mentioned recently our partnership with Sleepphones, and they've decided to provide Sleepy Time Tales with a great new bonus. For a limited time only, using the link I provide in the show notes and promo code SLEEPYTIME at checkout, they will provide you with a 10% discount on orders over $99.95, that's US dollars. So if you're tempted by the idea of trying out the comfort and convenience of headphones designed specifically for sleeping in, but the sticker price of a wireless pair is a bit much, or you'd like to buy a few wired sets for the family, now is the time. And as I say, this is a limited time offer, so please don't delay. And of course, if you'd also like to help Sleepy Time Tales, there's the usual method of the good old Patreon. This is up on patreon.com/sleepytimetales, and is monthly support that not only helps me keep the lights on, but can get you fun bonuses based on your contribution level. From as little as $2 a month, you get weekly access to early release on main episodes, so that you get your fresh sleep aid on a Wednesday instead of a Sunday. And $5 gets you weekly bonus minisodes, special edits, and a monthly megasode, which is all of the previous month's releases in one big listen. Tonight I'd like to shout out Tommy for signing up to the Patreon and joining the Sleepy Time Tales team. He helps me to keep the show going and available for free to all listeners. Welcome, Tommy. I'm thankful for your support. And a shout out goes as well to his partner, Kara, who was the one who actually discovered the show and shared it with him. Thanks for spreading the word. Because something I say quite a lot is telling people about Sleepy Time Tales may in a lot of ways be even more helpful than direct financial support. Because the more people who are here, the more people who are well rested, and the more people I can reach. So thank you, Tommy, and thank you, Kara. Here's to many more good night's sleep for the both of you. Also, tonight, we'd like to shout out the music, which is Sweet Nights and Friends by Kumiku. Their music is available on their website at loyaltyfreakmusic.com and is definitely well worth a listen. Thanks for taking the time. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Time Tales? What is it for? What is this strange thing, this strange idea, this podcast you're supposed to fall asleep to? But lack of sleep is a health crisis, and this is a podcast intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night? Mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Time Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night. Or maybe sometimes background noise or company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you, without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage. The primary idea behind Sleepy Time Tales is that it gives you something to focus on, a story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties, to help you to focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep. But maybe you need something a bit different. Maybe you just need some kind of background noise. Sometimes people like white noise or the sound of the ocean, or the wind in the trees, or the rain, or maybe just some boring dude droning on in the background. It's important, though, as you listen, that you don't try to force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the story and allow the need for sleep to come for you. Now, obviously, I'm hoping that you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode, but don't feel pressurized. It may not work on the first night. It will probably take a couple of nights for you to get used to listening to my voice. Maybe my accent is strange to you. Maybe one episode just isn't long enough. Or maybe your problem isn't going to sleep. Maybe your problem is waking up in the middle of the night. What I recommend, because it's what works for me, is to let the podcast run all night. Playlist or download a whole bunch of episodes, put them in a playlist, and let them go. That way, if you wake up in the middle of the night and the stream is still running and you're awake, you can just pop your buds back in and allow yourself to go straight back to sleep again. You can even do the same thing if you wake up just before your alarm. 60 minutes or even as little as 30 minutes. You wake up, see the time, know you've got some time left, pop your earbuds back in and back to sleep again. And it may sound strange, what an odd suggestion. What good is an extra 30 minutes of sleep after all? But I've had people actually email me and thank me for suggesting they do that. Because there's something about allowing yourself complete relaxation right before the alarm that is satisfying on a whole new level. It's important as you listen, though, to try to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this will probably seem strange to you. So give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you, to create a safe space, a cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course, you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. We return once again to Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. We crowded round, and over Miss Cathy's head I had a peep at a dirty, ragged, black-haired child, big enough both to walk and talk. Indeed, its face looks older than Catherine's, yet when it was set on its feet, it only stared round, and repeated over and over again some gibberish that nobody could understand. I was frightened, and Mrs. Earnshaw was ready to fling it out of doors. She did fly up, asking how I could fashion to bring that brat into the house, when they had their own bairns to feed and fend for. What he meant to do with it, and whether he were mad. The master tried to explain the matter, but he was really half dead with fatigue, and all that I could make out, amongst his scolding, was a tale of his seeing it starving and houseless, and as good as dumb in the streets of Liverpool, where he picked it up and inquired for its owner. Not a soul knew to whom it belonged, he said, and his money and time being both limited, he thought it better to take it home with him at once, than run into vain expenses there, because he was determined he would not leave it as he found it. Well, the conclusion was that my mistress grumbled herself calm, and Mr. Earnshaw told me to wash it and give it clean things and let it sleep with the children. Hindley and Cathy contented themselves with looking and listening till peace was restored. Then both began searching their father's pockets for the presents he had promised them. The former was a boy of 14, but when he drew out what had been a fiddle, crushed to morsels in the greatcoat, he blubbered aloud. And Cathy, when she learnt the master had lost her whip in attending on the stranger, showed her humour by grinning and spitting at the stupid little thing. Earning for her pains a sound blow from her father to teach her cleaner manners. They entirely refused to have it in bed with them, or even in their room. And I had no more sense, so I put it on the landing of the stairs, hoping it might be gone on the morrow. By chance, or else attracted by hearing his voice, it crept to Mr. Earnshaw's door, and there he found it on quitting his chamber. Inquiries were made as to how it got there. I was obliged to confess, and in recompense for my cowardice and inhumanity, was sent out of the house. This was Heathcliff's first introduction to the family. On coming back a few days afterwards, for I did not consider my banishment perpetual, I found I had christened him Heathcliff. It was the name of a son who died in childhood, and has served him ever since, both for Christian and surname. Miss Cathy and he were now very thick, but Hindley hated him, and to say the truth, I did the same, and we plagued and went on with him shamefully, for I wasn't reasonable enough to feel my injustice, and the mistress never put in a word on his behalf when she saw him wronged. He seemed a sullen, patient child, hardened perhaps to ill treatment. He would stand Hindley's blows without winking or shedding a tear, and my pinches moved him only to draw in a breath and open his eyes, as if he had hurt himself by accident, and nobody was to blame. This endurance made old Earnshaw furious when he discovered his son persecuting the poor fatherless child, as he called him. He took to Heathcliff strangely. Believing all he said, for that matter, he said precious little, and generally the truth, and petting him up far above Cathy, who was too mischievous and wayward for a favourite. So from the very beginning he bred bad feeling in the house, and at Mrs. Earnshaw's death, which happened in less than 2 years after, the young master had learned to regard his father as an oppressor rather than a friend, and Heathcliff as a usurper of his parents' affections and his privileges. And he grew bitter with brooding over these injuries. I sympathized a while, but when the children fell ill of the measles, and I had to tend them and take on me the cares of a woman at once, I changed my idea. Heathcliff was dangerously sick. And while he lay at the worst, he would have me constantly by his pillow. I suppose he felt I did a good deal for him, and he hadn't wit to guess that I was compelled to do it. However, I'll say this. He was the quietest child that ever nurse watched over. The difference between him and the others forced me to be less partial. Cathy and her brother harassed me terribly. He was as uncomplaining as a lamb. Their hardness, not gentleness, made him give me little trouble. He got through, and the doctor affirmed it was in a great measure owing to me, and praised me for my care. I was vain of his commendations and softened towards the being by whose means I earned them. And thus Hindley lost his last ally. I still couldn't dote on Heathcliff, and I wondered often what my master saw to admire so much in the sullen boy, who never to my recollection repaid his indulgence by any sign of gratitude. He was not insolent to his benefactor, he was simply insensible. Though knowing perfectly the hold he had on his heart, and conscious he had only to speak, and all the house would be obliged to bend to his wishes. As an instance, I remember Mr. Earnshaw once bought a couple of colts at the parish fair, and gave the lads each one. Heathcliff took the handsomest, but it soon fell lame, and when he discovered it, he said to Hindley, "You must exchange horses with me, I don't like mine. And if you won't, I shall tell your father of the 3 thrashings you've given me this week, and show him my arm, which is black to the shoulder." Hindley put out his tongue and cuffed him over the ears. "You'd better do it at once," he persisted, escaping to the porch. "They're in the stable. You will have to. And if I speak of these blows, you'll get them again with interest." "Off, dog," cried Hindley, threatening him with an iron weight used for weighing potatoes and hay. "Throw it," he replied, standing still. "And then I'll tell how you boasted that you would turn me out of doors as soon as he died, and see whether he will not turn you out directly." Hindley threw it, hitting him on the breast, and down he fell, but staggered up immediately, breathless and white. And, had I not prevented it, he would have gone just so to the master, and got full revenge by letting his condition plead for him, intimating who had caused it. "Take my colt then," said young Earnshaw, "and I pray that he may break your neck. Take him and be damned, you beggarly interloper, and wheedle my father out of all he has. Only afterwards show him what you are, imp of Satan, and take that. I hope he'll kick out your brains." Heathcliff had gone to loose the beast and shift it to his own stall. He was passing behind it when Hindley finished his speech by knocking him under its feet, and without stopping to examine whether his hopes were fulfilled, ran away as fast as he could. I was surprised to witness how coolly the child gathered himself up and went on with his intention, exchanging saddles and all, and then sitting down on a bundle of hay to overcome the qualm which the violent blow had occasioned, before he entered the house. I persuaded him easily to let me lay the blame of his bruises on the horse. He minded little what tale was told, since he had what he wanted. He complained so seldom indeed of such stirs as these, that I really thought him not vindictive. I was deceived completely, as you will hear. Chapter 5. In the course of time, Mr. Earnshaw began to fail. He had been active and healthy, yet his strength left him suddenly, and when he was confined to the chimney corner, he grew grievously irritable. And nothing vexed him, and suspected slights of his authority nearly threw him into fits. There was especially to be remarked if anyone attempted to impose upon or domineer over his favourite. He was painfully jealous lest a word should be spoken amiss to him, seeming to have got into his head the notion that because he liked Heathcliff, all hated and longed to do him an ill turn. It was a disadvantage to the lad, for the kinder among us did not wish to fret the master, so he humoured his partiality, and that humouring was rich nourishment to the child's pride and black tempers. Still, it became in a manner necessary. Twice or thrice Hindley's manifestation of scorn, while his father was near, roused the old man to a fury. He seized his stick to strike him and shook with rage when he could not do it. At last our curate, we had a curate then who made the living answer by teaching the little Lintons and Earnshaws, and farming his bit of land himself, advised that the young man should be sent to college. And Mr. Earnshaw agreed, though with a heavy spirit, for he said Hindley was naught, and would never thrive as where he wandered. I hope Tartary should have peace now. It hurt me to think the master should be made uncomfortable by his own good deed. I fancied the discontent of age and disease arose from his family disagreements, as he would have it that it did. Really, you know, sir, it was in a sinking frame. We might have got on tolerably, notwithstanding, but for two people. Miss Cathy and Joseph, the servant. You saw him, I dare say, up yonder. He was, and is yet, most likely, the wearisomest, self-righteous Pharisee that ever ransacked a Bible to rake the promises to himself and fling the curses to his neighbours. By his knack of sermonizing and pious discoursing, he contrived to make a great impression on Mr. Earnshaw, and the more feeble the master became, the more influence he gained. He was relentless in worrying him about his soul's concerns, and about ruling his children rigidly. He encouraged him to regard Hindley as a reprobate, and night after night he regularly grumbled out about a string of tales against Heathcliff and Catherine, always minding to flatter Earnshaw's weakness by heaping the heaviest blame on the latter. Certainly she had ways with her as I never saw a child take up before, and she put all of us past our patience 50 times and oftener in a day, from the hour she came downstairs till the hour she went to bed. We had not a minute's security that she wouldn't be in mischief. Her spirits were always at high water mark, her tongue always going, singing, laughing, and plaguing everybody who would not do the same. A wild, wicked slip she was, but she had the bonniest eye, the sweetest smile, and the lightest foot in the parish. And after all, I believe she meant no harm. For when once she made you cry in good earnest, it seldom happened that she would not keep you company and oblige you to be quiet that you might comfort her. She was much too fond of Heathcliff. The greatest punishment we could invent for her was to keep her separate from him. Yet she got chided more than any of us on his account. In play, she liked exceedingly to act the little mistress, using her hands freely and commanding her companions. She did so to me, but I would not bear slapping and ordering, and so I let her know. Now, Mr. Earnshaw did not understand jokes from his children. He had always been strict and grave with them, and Catherine, on her part, had no idea why her father would be crosser and less patient in his ailing condition than he was in his prime. His peevish reproofs wakened in her a naughty delight to provoke him. She was never so happy as when we were all scolding her at once, and she defying us with her bold, saucy look and her ready words, turning Joseph's religious curses into ridicule, baiting me and doing just what her father hated most, showing how her pretended insolence, which he thought real, had more power over Heathcliff than his kindness. How the boy would do her bidding in anything, and his only when it suited his own inclination. After behaving as badly as possible all day, she sometimes came fondling to make it up at night. "Nay, Cathy," the old man would say, "I cannot love thee, thou art worse than thy brother. Go say thy prayers, child, and ask God's pardon. I doubt thy mother and I must rue that we ever reared thee." This made her cry at first, and then being repulsed continually hardened her, and she laughed if I told her to say she was sorry for her faults and begged to be forgiven. But the hour came at last that ended Mr. Earnshaw's troubles on earth. He died quietly in his chair one October evening, seated by the fireside. A high wind blustered around the house and roared in the chimney. It sounded wild and stormy, yet it was not cold, and we were all together. I, a little removed from the hearth, busy at my knitting, and Joseph reading his Bible near the table, for the servants generally sat in the house then after their work was done. Miss Cathy had been sick, and that made her still. She leant against her father's knee, and Heathcliff was lying on the floor with his head in her lap. I remember the master, before he fell into a doze, stroking her bonny hair. It pleased him rarely to see her gentle, and saying, "Why canst thou not always be a good lass, Cathy?" And she turned her face up to his and laughed and answered, "Why cannot you always be a good man, father?" But as soon as she saw him vexed again, she kissed his hand and said she would sing him to sleep. She began singing very low till his fingers dropped from hers and his head sank on his breast. When I told her to hush and not stir for fear she should wake him, we all kept as mute as mice at full half hour, and should have done so longer. Only Joseph, having finished his chapter, got up and said he must rouse the master for prayers in bed. He stepped forward and called him by name, and touched his shoulder, but he would not move. So he took the candle and looked at him. I thought there was something wrong as he set down the light, and seizing the children each by an arm, whispered them to frame upstairs and make little din. They might pray alone that evening, he had somewhat to do. "I shall bid father good night first," said Catherine, putting her arms round his neck before he could hinder her. The poor thing discovered her loss directly. She screamed out, "Oh, he's dead. Heathcliff, he's dead." And they both set up a heartbreaking cry. I joined my wail to theirs, loud and bitter. But Joseph asked what we could be thinking of to roar in that way over a saint in heaven. He told me to put on my cloak and run to Jimmerton for the doctor and the parson. I could not guess the use that either would be of then. However, I went through wind and rain and brought one, the doctor, back with me. The other said he would come in the morning. Leaving Joseph to explain matters, I ran to the children's room. Their door was ajar. I saw they had never lain down, though it was past midnight, but they were calmer and did not need me to console them. The little souls were comforting each other with the better thoughts than I could have hit on. No parson in the world ever pictured heaven so beautifully as they did, in their innocent talk. And while I sobbed and listened, I could not help wishing we were all there safe together. Chapter 6. Mr. Hindley came home to the funeral, and a thing that amazed us and set the neighbours gossiping right and left, he brought a wife with him. What she was and where she was born he never informed us. Probably she had neither money nor name to recommend her, or he would scarcely have kept the union from his father. She was not one that would have disturbed the house much on her own account. Every object she saw, the moment she crossed the threshold, appeared to delight her. And every circumstance that took place about her, except the preparing for the burial and the presence of the mourners. I thought she was half silly from her behaviour while that went on. She ran into her chamber and made me come with her. though I could have been dressing the children. And there she sat, shivering and clasping her hands and asking repeatedly, "Are they gone yet?" Then she began describing, with hysterical emotion, the effect it produced on her to see black, and started and trembled, and at last fell a-weeping. And when I asked what was the matter, answered, she didn't know, but she felt so afraid of dying. I imagined her as little likely to die as myself. She was rather thin but young, and fresh complexioned, and her eyes sparkled as bright as diamonds. I did remark, to be sure, that mounting the stairs made her breathe very quick, that the least sudden noise set her all in a quiver, and that she coughed troublesomely sometimes. But I knew nothing of what these symbols portended, and had no impulse to sympathize with her. "We don't in general take to foreigners here, Mr. Lockwood, unless they take to us first." Young Earnshaw was altered considerably in the 3 years of his absence. He had grown sparer and lost his colour, and spoke and dressed quite differently. And on the very day of his return, he told Joseph and me we must thenceforth quarter ourselves in the back kitchen and leave the house for him. Indeed, he would have carpeted and papered a small spare room for a parlour. But his wife expressed such pleasure at the white floor and huge glowing fireplace, at the pewter dishes and delf case and dog kennel, and the wide space there was to move about in, where they usually sat, that he thought it unnecessary to her comfort, and so dropped the intention. She expressed pleasure, too, at finding a sister among her new acquaintance. She prattled to Catherine and kissed her and rang about with her, and gave her quantities of presents at the beginning. Her affection tired very soon, however. And when she grew peevish, Hindley became tyrannical. A few words from her, evincing a dislike to Heathcliff, were enough to rouse in him all his old hatred of the boy. He drove him from their company to the servants, deprived him of the instructions of the curate, and insisted that he should labour out of doors instead, compelling him to do so as hard as any other lad on the farm. Heathcliff bore his degradation pretty well at first, because Cathy taught him what she learnt, and worked or played with him in the fields. They both promised fair to grow up as rude as savages, the young master being entirely negligent how they behaved, and what they did, so they kept clear of him. He would not even have seen after their going to church on Sundays. Only Joseph and the curate reminded his carelessness when they absented themselves, and that reminded him to order Heathcliff a flogging, and Catherine a fast from dinner or supper. But it was one of their chief amusements to run away to the moors in the morning and remain there all day, and the after punishment grew a mere thing to laugh at. The curate might set as many chapters as he pleased for Catherine to get by heart, and Joseph might thrash Heathcliff till his arm ached. They forgot everything the moment they were together again, at least the minute they had contrived some naughty plan of revenge, and many a time I've cried to myself to watch them, growing more reckless daily, and I not daring to speak a syllable for fear of losing the small power I still retained over the unfriended creatures. One Sunday evening it chanced that they were banished from the sitting room for making a noise, or a light offence of the kind, and when I went to call them to supper I would discover them nowhere. We searched the house above and below, and the yard and stables. They were invisible. And at last Hindley, in a passion, told us to bolt the doors, and swore nobody should let them in that night. The household went to bed, and I, too anxious to lie down, opened my lattice and put my head out to hearken, though it rained, determined to admit them in spite of the prohibition, should they return. In a while I distinguished steps coming up the road, and the light of a lantern glimmered through the rain. I threw a shawl over my head and ran to prevent them from waking Mr. Earnshaw by knocking. There was Heathcliff by himself. It gave me a start to see him alone. "Where is Miss Catherine?" I cried hurriedly. "No accident, I hope." "At Thrushcross Grange," he answered, and I would have been there too, but they had not the manners to ask me to stay. "Well, you will catch it," I said. "You will never be content till you scent about your business. What in the world led you wandering to Thrushcross Grange?" "Let me get off my wet clothes and I'll tell you all about it, Nelly," he replied. I bid him beware of rousing the master. And while he undressed and I waited to put out the candle, he continued. "Kathy and I escaped from the wash house to have a ramble at liberty. And getting a glimpse of the Grange lights, we thought we would just go and see whether the Lintons passed their Sunday evenings shivering in corners, while their father and mother sat eating and drinking, and singing and laughing, and burning their eyes out before the fire. Do you think they do? Or reading sermons and being catechized by the manservant, and set to learn a column of scripture names if they don't answer properly?" "Probably not," I responded. "They are good children, no doubt, and don't deserve the treatment you receive for your bad conduct." "Don't can't, Nelly," he said. "Nonsense." We ran from the top of the heights to the park without stopping. Catherine completely beaten in the race because she was barefoot. "You'll have to seek for her shoes in the bog tomorrow." We crept through a broken hedge, groped our way up the path, and planted ourselves on a flower pot under the drawing room window. The lights came from thence. They could not put up the shutters, and the curtains were only half closed. Both of us were able to look in by standing on the basement and clinging to the ledge, and we saw. Ah, it was beautiful. A splendid place. Carpeted with crimson and crimson-covered chairs and tables, and a pure white ceiling bordered by gold. A shower of glass drops hanging in silver chains from the center, and shimmering with little soft tapers. Old Mr. and Mrs. Linton were not there. Edgar and his sisters had it entirely to themselves. Shouldn't they have been happy? We should have thought ourselves in heaven. And now, guess what your good children were doing? Isabella, I believe she is 11, a year younger than Kathy, lay screaming at the farther end of the room, shrieking as if witches were running red-hot needles into her. Edgar stood on the hearth, weeping silently, and in the middle of the table sat a little dog, shaking its paw and yelping, which from their mutual accusations we understood they had nearly pulled in two between them, the idiots. That was their pleasure, to quarrel who should hold a heap of warm hair, and each began to cry because both, after struggling to get it, refused to take it. We laughed outright at the petted things, we did despise them. When would you catch me wishing to have what Catherine wanted? Or find us by ourselves, seeking entertainment and yelling and sobbing and rolling on the ground, divided by the whole room? I'd not exchange for 1,000 lives my condition here for Edgar Linton's at Thrushcross Grange. Not if I might have the privilege of flinging Joseph off the highest gable and painting the house front with Hindley's blood. "Hush, hush," I interrupted. "Still you have not told me, Heathcliff, how Catherine is left behind." "I told you we laughed," he answered. "The Lintons heard us, and with one accord they shot like arrows to the door." There was silence, and then a cry. "Oh, Mama, Mama, oh, Papa, oh, Mama, come here, oh, Papa, oh." They really did howl out something in that way. We made frightful noises to terrify them still more, and then we dropped off the ledge because somebody was drawing the bars and we felt we had better flee. I had Kathy by the hand and was urging her on, when all at once she fell down. "Run, Heathcliff, run," she whispered. "They have let the bulldog loose and he holds me." The devil had seized her ankle, Nelly. I heard his abominable snorting. She did not yell out. No, she would have scorned to do it if she had been spitted on by the horns of a mad cow. I did, though. I vociferated curses enough to annihilate any fiend in Christendom, and I got a stone and thrust it between his jaws, and tried with all my might to cram it down his throat. A beast of a servant came up with a lantern at last, shouting, "Keep fast, Skulker, keep fast." He changed his note, however, when he saw Skulker's game. The dog was throttled off, his huge purple tongue hanging half a foot out of his mouth, and his pendant lips streaming with bloody slaver. The man took Kathy up. She was sick, not from fear, I'm certain, but from pain. He carried her in. I followed, grumbling execrations and vengeance. "What pray, Robert?" hallooed Lyndon from the entrance. "Skulker's caught a little girl, sir," he replied. "And there's a lad here," he added, making a clutch at me, "who looks an out and outer." Very like the robbers we were for putting them through the window to open the doors to the gang after all were asleep, that they might murder us at their ease. "Hold your tongue, you foul-mouthed thief, you. You shall go to the gallows for this." "Mr. Linton, sir, don't lay by your gun." "No, no, Robert," said the old fool. "The rascals knew that yesterday was my rent day, and they thought to have me cleverly. Come in, I'll furnish them a reception. There, John, fasten the chain. Give Skulker some water, Jenny. To beard a magistrate in his stronghold, and on the Sabbath, too. Where will their insolence stop?" "Oh, my dear Mary, look here. Don't be afraid. It is but a boy." Yet the villain scowled so plainly in his face. Would it not be a kindness to the country to hang him at once before he shows his nature in acts as well as features? He pulled me under the chandelier, and Mrs. Linton placed her spectacles on her nose and raised her hands in horror. The cowardly children crept nearer also. "Isabella, lisping, frightful thing, putting him in the cellar, Papa. He's exactly like that one that stole my pheasant, isn't he, Edgar?" While they examined me, Kathy came round. She heard the last speech and laughed. Edgar Linton, after an inquisitive stare, collected sufficient wit to recognize her. "They see us at church, you know, though we seldom meet them elsewhere." "That's Miss Earnshaw," he whispered to his mother. "And look how Skulker has bitten her, how her foot bleeds." "Miss Earnshaw? Nonsense," cried the dame. "Miss Earnshaw scouring the country with this child. And yet, my dear, the child is in mourning. Surely it is, and she may be lamed for life. And on that turnabout, I'm going to say goodnight. As always, you can pick this up where we've left off on Project Gutenberg. at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, a podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week. But make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get your new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.